digitally uploaded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second digitally downloaded podcast, Digitally Uploaded. I'm Matthew Sainsbury. I'm the editor-in-chief of Digitally Downloaded. And today I have here Chris.
Heyo.
And Alan.
Hey, guys. How you going?
Good, good. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Just, you know, dealing with the struggles of being an Australian at the moment, dealing with spiders, snakes, you know, the usual.
Yeah. The news this week, not related to the gaming industry, is that scientists in Australia have discovered a spider the size of a hand that can swim and fish. So
come,
if there wasn't
Australia
already enough stuff out there that wanted to get you, that one is a new addition to the family.
It is still less terrifying than Donald Trump, which is what I have to deal with right now.
All right. So let's jump into the podcast. Welcome back. That was a track from Blast and Bunnies, which is out this week or last week, from Aussie developer No. And that's a good segue into the news this week. I guess the big bit of news came via, well, at least for Australians, came via the Sony PlayStation Twitter account, where they proudly announced that in 1 week, 5 Aussie games have been released. And that was a little bit inaccurate because it's actually 6, but it's definitely good news for the games industry. And they're pretty good games too. I mean, we're talking about Screen Sheet, which I think just about everyone who's ever played GoldenEye will love.
It's wonderful. That is a great game. It's a very, very good, like, couch co-op game, which I miss a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it's one of those rare games these days that just playing online multiplayer isn't quite the same experience. It really does encourage you to get a bunch of friends around, pull out the beers, get some pizza, and kind of play it old school style. So
it's a brilliant concept.
Yeah, it's genius, really, because we've all done it. We've all done it in the past. Like, there's no hiding it.
It's very meta. It's very clever design.
It's really, really fun as well. It's just straight up ridiculous fun. I guess the next game we can probably talk about from this list, actually, is a wonderful game called Assault Android Cactus, which I've played a bit. It's wonderful. It's a twin-stick shooter. It plays absolutely wonderfully. It has a real kinetic feeling to everything that you do, which you don't really get that much anymore unless you're playing a nuclear throne or, like, a basically any sort of screen shake-heavy game by the nuclear throne guys. I mean, Chris, have you played Assault Android Cactus?
I have not, but I'm very much looking forward to it. I had actually been holding out for the PS4 release because I just thought I wanted to have it on console more than I wanted to have it on PC, so I'll be jumping on it very soon. I mean, it appeals to me on so many levels. As an old-school shooter shmup fan, I'm just obsessed with shmups like Raiden, the newer Raidens that have like a plethora of ships, so it's exciting to me to be reading about Cactus and how it has lots of different characters to unlock, all with wildly different shot styles and secondary weapons. Basically, I hear that the game changes basically almost entirely based on which character you pick, so I'm really excited to explore that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Matt, have you played it as well? Because I'm sure you'd probably love it.
No, I haven't. I would love to play it. I actually had it on my list of games to play on PlayStation Plus, assuming, of course, that people would have voted right and voted for that one to be the Plus game. And, of course, they didn't, so now I have to buy it. But I'll certainly be grabbing it when I get a chance, because it's definitely... I'm not the world's biggest fan of bullet hells and twin-stick shooters, but I do like them when they're well-designed, and I certainly think from everything that I've read about this one that it's going to be a very well-designed game. So, yeah, and being Aussie developed certainly helps too. Like to fly the flag for the local industry.
Exactly.
And the developers are wonderful people. I've talked with them on Twitter on several occasions. They're really good folks.
When I met them at PAX, they were really, really friendly guys. And they deserve every bit of success that they get. They're really, really nice.
Yeah, I got to catch up with them briefly at Tokyo Game Show about 2 years ago, I think. And yeah, they were the only Aussies there. Oh. And they were crammed into this big indie booth section, all by the lonesomes. But yeah, it was just nice having a bit of a local flavour there. And they were really cool guys. So best of luck to them. The third game comes from where the music that we've got on this podcast this week comes from, Blast 'Em Bunnies, which I have been playing. It's been a long time coming. The game was in a playable form back when they were showing off the PlayStation 4 ahead of its launch at EB Expo, 3 years ago or so. So it's been a long time coming. Thankfully, it's been worth it. It's a good little throwback to arcade shooters, and it's certainly cute with the bunnies. I like rabbits, so I'm a little bit conflicted about shooting them, but it's certainly entertaining and very colourful, very bright, very very much like Noh's previous games, and it's just nice having a little charming game on your PlayStation 4.
It looks like a good version of Naughty Bear. Like, it looks like a version of Naughty Bear that I actually want to play.
Yeah,
art style.
Similar aesthetic, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'll probably check that out, definitely. I mean,
yeah, it's worth it. I mean, it's a nice cheap download if you just want to buy the base game. There's a fair bit of DLC, but it's all kind of optional depending on what, you know, what backgrounds you want, what kind of bunny costumes you want them to have.
I was going to say, you can skin the bunnies, right? Because it looked like there were zombie bunnies in some of the screenshots on your review, and then there were normal ones. And I thought the zombie ones looked pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's a range of different bunny skins that you can get. Ninja, zombie, some kind of punk ghetto kids from the school bunnies. So, yeah, it's good. I mean, each of them's really charming. You don't have to buy them all, but it's nice to buy one or two based on, you know, what kind of games or what kind of styles you like. The base game itself is cheap enough that it's not really that big a deal if you do want to buy a couple of pieces of DLC either. Sure. The fourth Aussie game that came out this week was Gunscape, I believe its name is, which is a retro-style first-person shooter with a bit of a twist in that you actually create your own levels. So it's like Mario Maker meets Quake. And yeah, it's really, really good fun from what I played. I've only had a little spin with it, but yeah, it's... The creation tools are nice and robust. It's got full multiplayer. You can build arenas for deathmatch, or you can build co-op kind of narrative-based levels if you'd like. And it's a run-and-gunner. It's fast. It's what controls well. So, yeah, it's nice to have that on the PlayStation as well. Gives you a chance to be a bit creative.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great concept. I mean, because everything else has been building up towards this whole make-your-own-game sort of mentality. And I felt like Quake shooters were missing out on that because Quake shooters need a revival really badly. And I want more people to be playing them so I can actually have fun as well. I miss them so much. But yeah, this looks awesome. I'm definitely going to take a look at it as soon as I get off this podcast, actually. See if I can get it relatively reasonably priced, which I assume it is. And have a bit of fun with that and build a level.
Yeah, the more genres explore this make-your-own this make-your-own subgenre, the more interesting it becomes for me. It's not really something I've dipped my toes in a lot, but it's really cool to see different genres getting their own entries in it. I mean, I remember Blastworks on the Wii being a horizontal shmup that you could build your own ships and tinker with the levels. And, you know, obviously we've got Mario Maker. Even from what I understand, the new Doom is going to have some level-building aspects to it. So it's really cool.
Yeah, it's good to see. I mean, it's a good trend. All the companies are kind of experimenting with it. I mean, Nintendo's done it with some of the Mario and Donkey Kong puzzle platformers as well.
Smash Brothers with a level builder.
Yeah, exactly. So it's good. It encourages people to keep coming back and keep playing. It rewards them by giving them, you know, additional levels to play, I guess.
Limitless content.
Yeah, it's effectively unlimited content, and that's always good to see, especially if you really like the game. And it's relatively easy for the developers to then do unlimited content. It's kind of let's give the community the chance to do it. So, yeah.
Plus, it's actively encouraging the player base to engage with the art of design in a very accessible way, which is, you know, something that the industry's needed for a long time. Nothing will lead you to respect what your favorite developers go through better than having some tools handed to you and being asked to do it yourself a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And then the fifth game that PlayStation put a little call out to was one I don't think any of us had played and probably don't know much about, which is Square Heroes, which I feel bad about now that it is one of the Aussie games that came out this week. I should check that one out. But there's probably not much else we can say about that.
It's a game. It exists. I'll probably take a look at it after this again because, yeah, like you, I feel really bad. Yeah, I need to check all these out, actually, because I know I'm definitely going to buy a screen sheet, definitely buying Cactus, going to take a look at Blast and Bunnies and Gunscape for sure, and I have no idea what Square Heroes is, but it looks kind of cute, so I want it.
And then one that PlayStation kind of forgot about, and probably reasonably when you consider the material that was in the game, there's a lacrosse game that has come out this week, and against all odds, it was an Aussie development team that created it. And I say that because lacrosse is about as popular in Australia as cricket is in the US, if not less so.
You basically,
who's ever played lacrosse in Australia, if you're a fan of the sport, you don't get it on TV. Most Australians, I suspect, don't know much more about it other than they have sticks and throw balls at each other. Yes. So,
and also
I've been playing around with that a little bit, and I can say that it is it's actually really good. I mean, the development team behind it, Big Ant, I always say Red Ant, but Red Ant went out of business ages ago. Big Ant is a very talented sports developer. They created the Don Bradman cricket series and the rugby and AFL sporting games.
Oh, it's those guys. Come out.
Yeah. So they're basically specialists in kind of those niche, uber niche sports, and they have these pretty good engines that they manage to adapt to different sports. So it's good to see a lacrosse game out there, one that's actually playable and, you know, is good for the sport. I've always been a fan of these niche sports having proper representation in video games because it does help develop the sport to new audiences. So yes, that's the sixth Aussie game that's come out this week in a very busy week for Aussie developers. Welcome back again. That was another track from Blast and Bunnies. So now we're getting to the meat of the podcast this week, and I think, given that it was International Women's Day, well, last week now, by the time you listen to this, we thought that it would be a good idea to have a chat about our favourite video game characters that happen to be women and our favourite female video game developers, because, you know, there's a lot of them out there, and they probably don't get the credit they deserve a lot of the time. So we'll start by chatting about our favourite female characters, and I think we'll start with Chris, given that we're talking about Australia so much in the last segment. Let's give Chris a chance to talk.
Oh, that's sweet of you, Matt. So I think the character I'd like to talk about most today is, I'll look for an excuse to bring up Wild Arms again like I did last week, because it's my favourite JRPG series. Because Princess Cecilia from the first Wild Arms was probably, during my very formative years, one of the first female characters that really made me stand up and go, like, wow, she's incredible. You know, I think a lot of us, you know, was, oh, it's cool, Samus is a girl, but when I really started playing RPGs, which didn't happen for me until the 32-bit era, was when I finally started getting into more deep explorations of character, and Cecilia just knocked my socks off. In a lot of ways, she begins as a very stereotypical character, because she's a princess, so you're expecting a whole lot of cliches coming, and she's the magician and the summoner of the party, so here we go, more cliches, the girl is a princess and the magician and the summoner. But there's so many subtle things that happen throughout her story that it's just all great strength building, and you know, I don't really care about giving away spoilers for a game that's like almost 20 years old at this point, but you know, both her parents die when the metal demons come and take over. You know, start their assault on the human world in Wild Arms. It's this giant awakening for her that she has to rise to the occasion, not just to go on the grand adventure that is the game, but also reconcile her responsibilities as royalty. And that transformation is actually represented within the game visually, because her character sprite and her model are kind of very indicative of the princess appearance. She's got the long, beautiful blonde hair. She's wearing a rather ornate dress. But then when the moment finally happens, when she realizes she's going to go on this adventure with the other two protagonists, there's kind of this dramatic scene where she kind of goes to the edge of she cuts her own hair, which is something we see cut quite a bit in other properties as well. But, you know, she cuts this beautiful, long, flowing princess hair, and you kind of see this transformation into her being prepared for adventure. And where this happened, and when this happens, not only does her 2D sprite for the maps change, but her battle sprite also changes, her outfit changes completely. And it's one of the things that's reflected very beautifully in the iconic opening cinematic of the game as well. You know, and she just becomes this strong character, you know, reconciling this transition from a life of kind of protected luxury into becoming a formidable adventurer, an accomplished magician. One of the major plot points of the game is the search for these powerful golems that are ancient technology that has kind of the power to turn the tides of war. And it's just through her own compassion and strength of will that she's able to make friends with the Earth Golem, bring it to the side of the heroes, which then becomes one of your vehicles in the game. She's just a great character, strong, indomitable, and, you know, she undergoes this amazing character transformation. So that's Cecilia. She's awesome.
We do have, I guess there are some, there's quite a few coming-of-age stories out there in video games, especially in the JRPG genre, because it naturally lends itself to that kind of, development story. But yeah, I agree that probably there are some standouts, and, you know, Cecilia is probably a good example of that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess when it comes to female characters, there are a few that do stand out for me. I want to give a shout-out to Yuna from FFX, because she's awesome and really, really cool, and is surprisingly nuanced, given that FFX is the game that has the laugh scene. And I also I also do want to give a shout out to Lady Maria from Bloodborne, because she is the coolest character in that entire game, and her weapon is awesome, and she's super rad. And that's pretty much all I have to say about her, because I don't want to spoil anything. Because it's one of those things where, like, when you actually do meet her, you're like, oh, whoa. But I think probably I'm going to cop out a bit and use my XCOM team. Because, yeah, they're currently all versions of Michelle Rodriguez. bringing back Michelle Rodriguez's comments from last week, I picked up XCOM 2 a couple of days ago now, and I've been playing that a lot, and it's pretty much just making various versions of Michelle Rodriguez and Arnold Schwarzenegger and putting them on teams and having them be cool. And I don't know, there's something about having like a team of like badass like women rangers just destroying all these aliens and all these things in armor and these robots and everything. It's so cool. And
I can get that.
And pretty much anything, like anything character created, like my Saints Row president is awesome. She's like Russian, but she's not Russian anymore because they got rid of the Russian voice. So now she's like just sassy and she's awesome. And yeah. Ah, so cool.
There's something to be said for the empowerment that games that are heavily dependent on character creators gives us to make our own badass ladies if we want to, you know. I always used to play a woman in Phantasy Star and kind of make my own narratives up along the way.
Mass Effect's another good example of that.
Because FemShip's the best way to play that game.
Yeah, far. I can't imagine playing the game with a guy after, you know, going through the trilogy with the one woman. You definitely develop kind of a strong connection for them when you're kind of when you go through the creation process, and yeah, I certainly couldn't imagine ever playing Mass Effect with some dude.
Also, his voice acting isn't as good, I found, so yeah. I mean, it's still pretty good, but you know, it's nothing amazing comparatively compared to what's her name? The voice actor for FemShep is awesome, is what I'm trying to say. But I'm doing it as
very not Jennifer Hale, is it?
It might be Jennifer Hale.
Oh, actually, I put it blanking out too, I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, she's awesome, and shout outs because she's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I was to pick a female character, that kind of is a highlight for me, I guess I always end up coming back to Juliet Starlin from Lollipop Chainsaw, mostly because people who haven't played the game or buy into the reputation of the game immediately assume that, hey, look, it's a cheerleader, and you know, it's a sexy costume, so therefore she must be the kind of blonde bimbo role. And of course, by the time you get through to the end of the game, if you're paying attention, you realize that she's actually a very empowered character, and the entire character role of her is to basically subvert every expectation that you might have of her going into it. So I have always found Goichi Suda's games to be quite interesting from that perspective. They always, always, always try to flip things around. What you might expect and what you get are always different. And I think that lends some of the negative criticism that he gets as a result of his games, simply because people aren't getting what they expected, therefore they're a little bit confused when they're playing the game. But I do think that they make his games quite interesting and engaging, and certainly Juliet Starling is a very good example of a very strong female character. I mean, if we're to look at specific examples, there's the fact that she speaks multiple languages and her boyfriend character doesn't even know. There's the fact that her boyfriend character is literally just a head by the end of the first level, because she cuts his head off, and then because this is a Goichi Suda game, he manages to survive as a head. And he's completely disempowered, and he's completely, like, his only role in the game beyond, you know, embarrassing himself with some really stupid comments is to have his head stuck on a headless zombie, which Juliet then can control to have him do some menial tasks that, you know, she wouldn't otherwise bother with. So, yeah, I think that she's a very interesting character. She's positioned as being the empowered one. She's positioned as being the intelligent one. She's positioned as being kind of aloof to all the nonsense that goes on around her. And I think that's one of the few, actually, examples of a really empowered character that we've seen in recent years. So, yes, that's me on Lollipop Chainsaw. And welcome back again. So that was another song from Blastum Bunnies. As you can see, it's got some pretty funky music. So for the final segment this week, we thought we would talk about female video game designers that we all like, because there's a lot of them out there in the industry and they don't get the recognition they always deserve. Let's start with Chris. I believe that you have a special relationship with the Castlevania series, and that is largely because of the work of two particular women.
Oh, absolutely. Castlevania is my all-time favorite series or franchise or whatever you want to call it. And in my large game collection, Castlevania's got its own separate shelf. And much of that is due to Castlevania in the modern incarnation. You know, the EGA games that we've all come to associate with modern Castlevania, we often forget that the visual and aural design of those games, the art and the music, are the byproduct of two exceedingly talented women. Ayami Kojima on art and Michiru Yamane on music. I don't think there's any Castlevania fans out there who don't immediately think of Castlevania's music and the beautiful ephemeral designs of the characters. You know, whenever a new Castlevania design comes out, you know, we see those beautiful poster documents with Kojima's work. You know, those beautiful, slightly effeminate men. They're otherworldly, and the extreme ornateness of their costumes. It's they've come to define the series in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, any Castlevania fan has a strong connection to their artistic work.
Well, I mean, when you first mentioned that you wanted to talk about Castlevania, I just burst out and start singing Simon's theme, like, immediately. So
sure, sure.
It's obviously, like, it means a lot to a lot of people, and the fact that I didn't even grow up with that entire series, pretty much, I still know everything. I can still, like, love it so, so much. I mean, I go back and play Symphony of the Night every so often, and the art in that game and the music in that game is awesome.
Yeah,
so good.
It's unreal. It's unreal. And we're talking about, you know, a whole generation of gamers who this iconic series was defined by the visual and the sounds that these women created. We all talk about Iga and his amazing design sensibilities for making the games play the way they do, but it's just so important to recognize the artistic contributions as well that really shaped, you know, you can't have a work of gothic fiction without beautiful ornate work and moody music. It's just not possible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's immediately iconic. You show anyone any of the art that's been made for that game, and you just know immediately that that's what it's going for. And that doesn't happen very often. There's nothing that's really as sort of iconic, immediately iconic, as what Castlevania does. And I think it's really impressive to have both a visual designer and a composer on that level at the same time on the same project. So, I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit sad to hear that that Kojima is not involved as much in the artwork for Bloodstained, but from what I understand, Mitsuru Yamane is handling the music on Bloodstained, so we'll still get a piece of that old Castlevania charm in there, along with Iga's designs.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Bloodstained looks great. I guess
well,
this is probably...
I was just going to say, it's certainly going to be better than the last couple of Castlevania games, the 3D ones.
What, the fighter as well? Like the one that was on the Wii?
Oh,
Judgment?
My goodness. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people...
shouldn't have reminded you. I'm sorry.
It wasn't a great game, but once again, you know what was good about it was...
The visual
design and the reimaginings of the classic characters. Now, Kojima wasn't necessarily responsible for the designs of those characters. I actually think the manga artist responsible for Rurouni Kenshin was commissioned to do the designs for that. But then she did render the official artworks of those designs, and they were once again just ephemeral and beautiful in her classic style.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that fighting game, I mean, it didn't have many redeeming qualities, but at least it was recognizable as a Castlevania game, and I know that's kind of damning it with faint praise, but I mean, it could have been even worse if it had the Castlevania name on it. And
well, that's right. It would have been abysmal. But instead, I got a 3D brawler where I could be Cornell, the awesome werewolf dude from the 64 Castlevania game, which was pretty sweet. So I'm not sorry I bought it.
Well, I guess this is probably a good time for me to take over with my favorite sort of female industry figure. So I grew up during the sort of early PS2 era, and when I got my PS2, when I was pretty young, I got a copy of Jak and Daxter on it, and Amy Hennig is responsible for most of my childhood now, and then most of my teenage years as well, simply because she basically started working on the Legacy of Kain series, which I didn't know until maybe about 3 or 4 years ago when I went back and played them. And then she moved on to Naughty Dog, obviously, and she worked on Jak and Daxter, then she wrote Uncharted. So she's pretty good, I'd say. Just, you know, she's all right, I guess. I mean, if you just write Uncharted, you know, it's not like it's well-written or anything. She's absolutely wonderful. I adore pretty much all of her games, and I'm so, so excited to see her new project at Visceral. I think she's at Visceral now with the Star Wars game.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that'll, in the least, it'll be written really well. So, I'm, you know, I'm keen. I'm so excited to see what she does in the future, because Uncharted 2 is one of my favorite games of all time, probably, just because of all the characters, and it's just, oh, what a writer. I also would like to...
If she's working on a Star Wars game, then at least it's going to be better than every other Star Wars game for the last couple of years. Because at least it'll have something worth paying attention to for a change.
So you don't like the Force... Wait, is it Force Unleashed? The terrible one? That sucked. It was like a hack and slash that was definitely not God of War.
They've all been terrible for a long time now.
Yeah, fair. I'm not going to argue with that. We all knew it happened in Battlefront.
It's not to the Old Republic, really.
Yeah. Oh, Battlefront 2 was really good.
I'll tell you what was a good Star Wars game. I mean, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but I don't think Republic Commando gets nearly the credit it deserves. That was a slick squad-based first-person shooter. Really tight. And I'll just drop that and then walk away. But...
And I think it's also a good opportunity to, you know, pay some homage to Rihanna Pratchett, who wrote the Tomb Raider games, like the reboots. They are generally quite well written, and, you know, she's pretty cool. And I have pretty much no qualms with the story for Rise of the Tomb Raider, so it's pretty good. Matt, do you have your favorite female game dev?
Oh, just on the note that you were talking about first, I guess the thing that I like about both of those ladies, Amy and Rhiannon, is that what they do is particularly impressive when you consider they're working in the AAA space.
Yes.
And it's pretty hard to do something innovative, creative, intelligent, worthwhile when you're working in a space that is really about pushing out gameplay to the overwhelming majority. So, you know, it's a tough space for them to be working in, and I think they do a really good job of it. I was also speaking to, I can't remember her name now, Mary something, who's the writer on the new Deus Ex game that's coming out.
She is the nicest person ever.
She was lovely.
She's so friendly.
I think that she's another example of one of these ladies that'll actually be able to do something interesting with a plot in a space that isn't really friendly to narrative.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
go ahead.
I really enjoyed the story for Human Revolution. Like, that was a wonderful, well-thought-out game. And I'm so excited to see what she does with Mankind Divided. Because that's, like, the main reason I want to play that game. Not because of anything else, because I want to play as Adam Jensen again, and I want to see what's happened and how I can ask for this. Because it's so... She brings up these really, really interesting themes and then works with them in a way that makes sense. And it's really, really clever, and I can't wait to see what she does in the future. It's absolutely wonderful. Anyway, Chris, what were you going to say? Sorry, I was just going to say,
it's interesting because we often think about these AAA games and the creativity of narrative and how a lot of these, a lot of these high-level artistic decisions for good narrative and excellent character development are kind of discouraged in the AAA sphere. But it's kind of funny how when a game comes along with, you know, a really talented writer like these women we're talking about right now, one of these games comes out, they're often the most celebrated games in the AAA sphere. You know, so it's interesting how AAA tends to not necessarily encourage this high-level narrative stuff, but then we think about the modern Tomb Raiders, Deus Ex, Uncharted, and what are they celebrated for? Not just their gameplay, but it's the strength of their narratives and their character development that push them to the next level and make them these celebrated titles in the AAA sphere. So it's kind of funny, and you'd think this high-level narrative stuff would be encouraged greater or explored greater in a larger number of AAA titles.
And I do think we will start to see a little bit more of that. It's not a great example of a great narrative or anything, but you can see even with last year's Call of Duty...
there was an attempt to try there.
There was an attempt to do something, and it wasn't a very good attempt, but it was an attempt. And I think that means a lot. You've also got the way the Assassin's Creed games are really starting to develop. They're in a rhythm, yes, but they're in a rhythm where they are trying to work history in an interesting way. And yeah, there are just examples of, and you've got Mirror's Edge coming out this year too, which would be AAA and hopefully tell a strong story. So you do see that these publishers are actually trying, and I think that's good. I hope they keep trying. I hope there's not pushback from the mass community that these are becoming walking simulators or whatever if the cutscene's too long. I just, yeah, I do hope they continue on this path, and I think the more voices that they can get into the industry, the better too. I think one of the reasons that we are celebrating these games from women is that it comes from a different voice to, you know, the kind of typical expectation of having, you know, a white guy kind of write the plot. The more women we get creating these stories, the more people from ethnic communities that we get creating these stories, the more varied the stories we'll get. And I think that'll be good as well when we start to see that push more often into the AAA industry.
That's a big world, and there's lots of different stories out there.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. It's just a matter of getting... And we do see it in the indie space. Obviously, we see a lot of very varied stories in the indie space. It's just about starting to push some of that creativity up into the AAA space. And I think it'll happen. I've got my fingers crossed it'll happen. It's just a matter of when.
Exactly.
But while we are talking about, I guess, smaller scale games and female creators, I'd like to bring up two ladies, Sunako and Naoko Mizuno, who are both very lovely people that I was able to interview for my book, Shameless Plug.
But that's the second time that you've done that today.
I do it wherever I can. I've got it. People don't really realize who these people are, I guess, for the most part, unless you're an existing fan. But they're actually the team that the tag team behind a lot of the creativity in the Hyperdimension Neptunia series, which surprises a lot of people because people see that series and they immediately assume that it's kind of nerdy 2D fan men that write them. But in actual fact, yes, it's definitely they're both women, and they are both the creative forces behind the games. Sunako is the one that does the art. So she does all the character design, all the background stuff. She really kind of drives the visual side of those games. And then Naoko Mizuno is the one that does the... she's the producer. So she's basically responsible for the way the project comes together as a game. And we've seen her improve a great deal as a producer from her first project, which was the original Hyperdimension Neptunia, which, if you ask anyone, even the fans, will agree that it's a pretty awful game. Some nice ideas in there, but a pretty awful game. But from that point, the series has really gone from strength to strength, and they're now legitimately good JRPGs that I would consider to be of equal par to any, you know, any other JRPGs that don't come from the big studios in terms of quality and refinement. And I think that those games, those two women are definitely worth keeping an eye on as they continue to make more games or make more art in the sense in Sunako's case. And I think it's just a nice fact to know that those games are actually created by women.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's important too to talk about you know, in the Hyperdimension Neptunia games, the amount of fan service that's often criticized, it's coming from Sunako. And we're not just talking about the character designs, but the fan service scenes. You know, every time Neptune takes a tumble and you know, things get jiggly and someone has to bandage her up and everyone's crying foul, that's a woman drawing those. And she's very attached to the characters and invested in these characters. It's not a sweaty dude drawing them, which everyone tends to assume, like you mentioned.
And she's absolutely... I mean, she's very much... She's just the kind of the very... when I was speaking to her, she's the kind of traditional-like Japanese lady that you might expect to meet if you didn't know anything about Japan, other than by, you know, fourth-hand reputation. She's very, very quiet, very demure, very... very friendly, very polite. So it's not the kind of person you would expect to be drawing these scenes. And I think that's fascinating in all in itself. The fact that she's basically become, in the eyes of many people, she's become the best example of a fan service style artist, because her work is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, if you can put aside whatever feelings you might have about fan service, if you can put that aside and you can actually look at the quality of her work, it's just amazing. Like, the detail, the way the cleanness of the lines that she draws, the use of color, it's all very, very creative, very, very attractive.
No, it's a distinct style. It's almost instantly recognizable. She achieves a softness with her shading and stuff that's really, really difficult. As someone who dabbles in digital drawing, I can attest firsthand to how extremely difficult it is to achieve the effects she does. And she's so prolific. To achieve the level of that detail that we're talking about, with the amount of character she designs, the amount of image she produces, it's just nothing short of impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And she doesn't just work in games either. She's obviously the character artist in the Data Live series of anime. Again, it's instantly recognizable that it comes from her when you see it. You're right. She comes up with characters on an incredibly... they certainly work you hard over at Idea Factory. They do work on a lot of projects, and they turn them out very quickly. So to be able to maintain a creative sense while you're doing that is a sign of a really good quality, very dedicated artist that's very confident in their own abilities. Okay, thank you for listening, everyone. I think that's pretty much everything we've got to talk about this week. So I would like to say thank you again for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We are still working on these podcasts week in, week out, so we are still refining the style and how we approach these things. If you've got any feedback or you've got any questions you'd like to ask us that we can perhaps bring up in the next podcast, feel free to let us know through one of the many channels that we're on. You can grab me on Twitter at @DigitallyDownLD, because I couldn't spell out downloaded in the number of characters Twitter gave me. You can grab Chris on
Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr at Mr. Gilder Pixels.
And Alan is at?
At IronsRoom on Twitter. I'm also just generally around in the Blackshot Media blog, where I do some design, discussion, and general sort of game development talk. So you can always find that at blackshotmedia.com/blog.
And, of course, you can always grab us on digitallydownloaded.net. So thank you again for listening. We'll say goodbye for this week and look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Digitally uploaded.